Well, as you know, and as Lou Rockwell has emphasized in his speech this noon, the 20th century was a century of bloodshed and mass murder, without precedent. And these crimes were disguised as social experiments which aimed at radically transforming society according to the whims of ever new dictators, some of which we know today. Now the remarkable thing is that those who were responsible for these crimes are today still held in high esteem all over the world. Those few who were staunch enough to oppose them and to fight back, on the other hand, are held in contempt and are ignored. One means to correct this unjust or unjust state of affairs is to make the work and the life of the champions of freedom better known. One means to accomplish that is to write and publish biographies of these men. Well, as Lou Rockwell has already mentioned it, I've been assigned to write a biography of Ludwig von Mises, and I do this. I'm very much honored by the Mises Institute, who is entirely supporting it. This decision has been spurred by the recent discovery of personal documents of Mises, which for decades were deemed to be lost forever. The analysis of these documents will bring new light on the life and work of this great man, and it might therefore be appropriate to explain their importance and how we finally got a hold of them in more detail, and this is what I'm going to do now. As you know, Mises lived and grew up in Vienna. I'm not a big artist, but I try to draw an essential map of the first district of Vienna.
So Vienna is much bigger than that. And the first district of this divided the center of Vienna, and it contains one of the most important institutions for Austria, which is essentially the opera and the opera.
Well, so in the first district, the major cultural, administrative, economic, and financial institutions of the empire were concentrated. Here was the Hofburg. Oh, well, I didn't. So the Hofburg, the opera, the university, the stock exchange that is in the north, I didn't sign it in either. So you see, I've got a very reduced view of the important institutions. The Academy of the Arts and the headquarters of the major companies. Yet this was not a mere concentration as in other capitals. These institutions were not unconnected, but formed the institutional framework of a truly remarkable and outstanding biosphere. Characteristically, the Viennese elites would not ignore one another, but take part in an all-encompassing social life that would bring together ministers and students, opera singers and scientists, stockbrokers and historians of art, philosophers and painters, psychologists and novelists, office clerks and architects, and so on in numberless variations. The Viennese were enthusiastic about science and knowledge, about beauty and art. Talking and thinking about science and art were not reserved for special persons or for the holidays or other special occasions. It was part of Vienna's daily and common life. Virtually everybody in Vienna, from the emperor to the housewife, knew something about the latest achievements of science and held some opinion about this and that actor or this and that novel. Thus the young artists and scientists grew up among many persons who were interested in what they were doing and, most importantly, who could, to some degree at least, challenge their views in one of the numberless coffee house discussions. This permanent criticism sharpened the senses in the minds of the young intellectuals, and it established high standards that were truly uncommon at other times and places. In short, the city of Vienna in its glorious days from the 1870s to the 1930s was a cultural hothouse. was a hothouse that should shape much of what is valuable in 20th century civilization. To name just a few accomplishments, it was the birthplace of phenomenology, of psychoanalysis, and of Jugendstil. It was one of the cradles of modern analytical philosophy, and most importantly, it was the birthplace and home of Austrian economics, that school of thought that Ludwig von Mises were to transform and lead to new heights. It is not surprising that a genius like Mises should develop his faculties in such a stimulating environment. It is almost sure that Mises would meet colleagues and friends several times a day on the streets of Vienna. In fact, the Mises family lived on the third floor of a nice tenant house ornamented by a Baroque facade with a heavy iron
door in a street called Waldseiler, maybe for the wall that comes from Ruhr. So you can guess that this street was Ruhr merchants for the time. So they living in a house in the north, eastern part of the first place.
From here, Ludwig the pupil would walk 10 minutes to a school, the Akademisches Gymnasium. As a student, he would walk 15 minutes to get to the University of Vienna to sit in Bernd Barbach's famous seminar. And later on, when he worked for the Chamber of Commerce, it would take him even less than 5 minutes to his office.
So I mentioned these details only because I've been in Vienna. It was one of the deepest impressions that everything was so concentrated in school. Starting from Mises' home, you can walk here in 10 minutes, you're on the other side of the city center, 15 minutes, it's so close. And then it's not very surprising that all these famous persons on a daily basis. That is one of the reasons why there hardly exists any correspondence, for example, between Mises and Schulte. I want to say, well, they didn't have to say so much to one another. But even Mises and his other friends, they wouldn't correspond because there was no need to correspond, except in emergency cases. They would send somebody transmit an urgent message. So by and large, wherever you are, can get to the other side, directly opposed side, in 20 minutes or half an hour. So Waldseiler 24 was virtually the geographical center of these three institutions which shaped its early years. The Gymnasium, the Chamber of Commerce, and of course, as you know, that he was a great admirer of the opera and of theater. The Hoftheater is the most eminent theater in Vienna or the German world. Well, and therefore we can imagine that, of course, several times a day, of course, the city and the people.
However, Waldseiler 24 was not only a geographical center, it was, as it should be the case with the true home, much more than a geographical center. It was, of course, the center of his private life, the indispensable emotional framework for all his undertakings, and, which is more important as far as Austrian economics is concerned, it was the personal center of learning. Here he built up his impressive personal library, and amidst the works of great minds of all centuries, he would work out his own theories. Books are the best university, was one of his mottos, and as always he would live up to what he said. Hours and hours, night after night, he would sit there and study and write those books that should eventually become a blessing to mankind as they changed the lives of readers all over the world. This private place, therefore, where Mises would retire in the evenings when he came back from work in the University of Vienna or in the Chamber of Commerce, is the cradle of modern Austrian economics and of modern libertarianism.
So we should park this only place in
the Red Circle. Well, it might be a suggestion for
the Mises Institute has succeeded in bringing a commemorative in the Chamber of Commerce, the right place, and it would probably be here, I don't think.
Clearly, no other place in Europe can compare in significance for Mises' work. The documents and records that he kept here reflected his activities as a pupil in the Akademischen Gymnasium, as a student at the University of Vienna, as an officer in the Austro-Hungarian Army, as a scholar and professor, and as a public man. Thanks to research supported by the Mises Institute, we have now a relatively clear idea of what was in Mises' private library office, as he called it. His library comprised approximately 2,000 volumes and 1,000 brochures, the sheer enumeration of which reflects the enormous scope and depth of his scholarship. His collection contained books and journals on economics, public finance and the history of public finance, on monetary policy, on the history of money and banking, on banking statistics, on history in general and on the history of Austria in particular, on law, on the history of law and legislation, on economic history, on philosophy, on sociology, etc., etc., etc. Mises owned over 100 volumes of law books alone. The complete works of Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Feuerbach, the publications of the Kant Society, special editions of Greek and Roman philosophers, and of course you all read these guys in the original Greek and German, Greek and Roman. The Roman philosophers were not as advanced as the published in German. He owned works by Lamarck and Darwin, and he owned Auguste Comte's five-volume Cours de Philosophie Politique. In fiction, he owned the complete works of Walter von der Vogelweide, Goethe, Schiller, Uhland, Grillparzer, Heine, Freiligrath, Kleist, Richard Wagner, Konrad Ferdinand Meyer, of Racine, Corneille, Molière, and of Byron and Shakespeare. And he read all these scientific works, novels, poetry, and theater plays in their original German, English, French, and Italian languages. Among his records were letters that his mother sent him during World War I to the battlefields of Galicia. And I'll tell you, this is really a big pleasure to read it when Mises' mother would ask him again and again, did you receive the socks? And the cognac and the cigarettes that she would send. He has letters from friends and colleagues all over Europe. He also had several letters from a certain Margaret Serenny, which would later become his wife. A particular treasure were several letters by Böhm Barberg dealing with epistemological problems of economics. Mises valued also very highly two letters by his friend Seipel, one dealing with the Austrian currency reform of 1922, and the other concerning Austria's ability, or rather inability, to live on her own, that is, political independence from the German Reich. A more personal treasure were the family records, comprising old letters and certificates, and copies from the archive of Austria's royal chancellor, which burned down in 1927. Mises also kept records about his military service in the Austro-Hungarian army. These documents show, among other things, that Mises was well acquainted with the organizational details of German war socialism. That means he was well acquainted with the reality of socialism even before he set out to demonstrate the impossibility of socialist calculation. Moreover, Mises owned copies of the memoranda he had written as a staff member of the Austro-Hungarian army on problems of war finance and economics, and copies of all of his articles which appeared in scientific journals and newspapers, as well as copies of articles written about him or his work. Clearly, these documents are a precious testimony of the interwar period in Europe and in Austria, and they are essential for us to gain an understanding of Ludwig von Mises' personal, professional, and intellectual development. Fortunately, we now have access to these records. Yet for a long time, this seemed to be impossible because these documents were believed to be lost forever in consequence of events that shook the history of Austria and of the entire world. So let me talk a little bit about the odyssey of the Mises records. In April 1937, Mises' mother died. He himself worked at the time already as a professor in Geneva, as you know. So this could have been the moment for him to break all ties with Vienna. He could have taken all these things out of the apartment and made Geneva definitely the new center of his life. However, on the one hand, Mises' contract in Geneva was on an annual basis, and there was no prospect of tenure. On the other hand, Vienna was, after all, much more than just the place where he happened to live the first 53 years of his life. It was a unique place in its own right. This place attracted him immensely, and he hoped to spend the evening of his life there. Mises also did not want to abandon his home, where his family had lived, and where he lived with his mother for more than 25 years. Last but not least, he would not abandon his private library office, where he worked out his ideas on the theory of value, on money, on economic calculation, and the impossibility of socialism, on banking and the business cycle, on the self-reinforcing nature of interventions, on the synthetic a priori character of economics, etc. So he decided to keep a foot in this apartment as a personal basis, or personal base in Vienna. With the owner of the apartment, he agreed that it should be let to the physician Dr. Reises, and that Mises should sublet from Reises the room which contained his library. In the following months, Mises would frequently return to Vienna, sleep in a hotel, and spend some time of the day in his library office. There he would think through his new ideas and commemorate his mother, who must have been ever present to him in these sacred rooms. The rest of his time in Vienna, Mises spent quietly preparing his future life. At the end of February 1938, he came to Vienna making arrangements for his wedding with Margit Seremin. The law provided that the announcement of their wedding be posted for 6 weeks on the front door of the Stephansdom. When Mises returned to Geneva, he expected to marry Margit at the beginning of April. He could not foresee that this had been his last visit to Vienna for many years, and that terrible events should transform his beloved hometown forever. In fact, on the 12th of March 1938, Adolf Hitler sent his troops into Austria to prevent a referendum on Austria's independence, which was supposed to take place the next day. These troops virtually met no resistance from Austria's army and civilians, and so they reached the city of Vienna on the very same day and took control of Austria's command posts. The Nazis lost no time to suffocate any resistance right from the beginning. They immediately started sending out Gestapo task forces to arrest their most eminent Austrian enemies and to bring important records and other evidence under their control. All Jewish organizations in Vienna, all political party organizations, and many private persons fell prey to this action. One group of Gestapo men was sent to Walzeile 24. The men in black overcoats would march up the steps of the third floor and knock on the door of the Reises family. The Reises were, of course, shocked when these representatives of the Nazi party, as they introduced themselves, forced their way to the Mises library office, but resistance was, of course, impossible. They broke in the door and took everything with them. And this literally means everything that could possibly be taken out of this room. Personal documents, books, manuscripts, paintings, silver, carpets, furniture, clothes, and underwear. I wonder what they've done with the underwear. They claimed that these items were to be handed over to a penal court, but of course nothing of this sort ever happened. The Mises records and the precious library were lost without a trace. Mises tried hard to get them back, but all efforts were in vain. His belongings seemed to be lost forever. We now know that the Mises records, along with the looted documents of other Viennese organizations and private persons, were brought to Berlin and stored in a department of the Deutsche Arbeitsfront. This was a Nazi research institute charged with the analysis of intellectual enemies, whether communists or libertarians. What use the DAF has made of the Mises records in the 6 years it had them at its disposal, we do not know. In any case, the Mises records remained at the DAF until 1944, when the Allied forces started marching toward Berlin. Then the whole DAF archive was moved to a more secure place. This place was a hidden castle in Bohemia, which was far from the battlefields. There the documents remained until the war was over, and in June 1945 the whole DAF archive was handed over to that Allied army which first arrived on the spot. Well, and unfortunately, this happened to be the Red Army. The Red Army brought its loot immediately to Moscow and stored it in a secret archive, which was newly built for the express purpose of hosting documents that had been taken over from the Nazis. They have really an incredible collection of documents there. For example, the entire records of the Auschwitz concentration camps are there. Another example are the Goebbels diaries, which you've certainly heard of. They've been published recently. The name of this archive was Special Archive for Historical Documentary Collections. And it was a very unusual name. And it was located in the small and quiet Vyborgskaya Street, which is about 10 miles north from the center of Moscow. Not many Russians, and hardly a Western foreigner, ever walk through this street. And this is true even now, as Moscow and Russia are open to foreign visitors. The archive with the documents from Germany and Austria was indeed one of the best kept secrets in Moscow. Eventually, things should change with the fall of the East Bloc. Shortly after the dramatic reforms that were begun in Russia, a Moscow female journalist published an article on the Special Archive for Historical Documentary Collections. This article drew for the first time the attention of Western scholars to this hitherto unknown archive. A German research team, with financial support from the West German trade unions, set out to visit the archive and to create a comprehensive list of its records. Because the Cold War was officially ended, the Russian authorities gave the necessary permission, and so the team led by Dr. Götz Ali would, in 1991, and after much freezing in the unheated study rooms of the archive, publish their German language report. Now, you must not think that these news spread like fire in the scientific world. Dr. von Habsburg very accurately observed yesterday in his address that professors are most of the time ignoring what their colleagues are doing. So it was in this case too. In complete ignorance of Ali's work, a team of Austrian scholars led by the professors Karcher and Jagdschütz, who traveled to Moscow, freeze again in the unheated study rooms of the archive, and eventually publish, by and large, the same findings as the Ali team. Both the Ali and the Karcher publications mentioned the Mises records. However, much more time had to pass before any Austrian economist would take notice of this findings. The first one to do so was my colleague, Professor Richard Ebeling, who traveled to Moscow in 1996 to analyze the Mises files and to buy Xeroxes of the most important documents. Spurred by this breakthrough, the Mises Institute immediately assigned me to write a biography of Ludwig von Mises, which would take advantage of this newly available material. And so it came that in the last summer, I myself set out to travel to Moscow to work with the original documents and to buy copies. Well, who would have thought that the heirs of Lenin and Stalin would make that much money with Ludwig von Mises' documents? Among other things, my journey was necessary because Professor Ebeling was not allowed to get copies of the entire Mises collection. I had to make my own selection, and here I profited from two circumstances. On the one hand, the copying policy of the archive had apparently become more liberal in the course of time, so that I was allowed to export many more copies than Ebeling was allowed to do. This change of policy certainly reflects the bad shape of Russia's state finances and the general immiseration of the country, which makes it necessary to earn money wherever possible. On the other hand, as some of you might have guessed in the meantime, I'm a native German speaker, and because virtually all of the Mises records are in German language documents, I could screen them relatively easily. Now, it came out that much of the 11,000 or so pages of the Mises files contained irrelevant material. For example, the Russians counted every single page of the journal in which Mises had published an article of 5 pages, whereas obviously only these 5 pages were relevant. Therefore, I could get copies of all relevant documents, approximately 6,500 pages, without running into conflict with Russian laws, which provide that only a part of the collection might be copied. As a result, the Mises Institute now owns copies of virtually all relevant documents that Mises left in his Vienna apartment in 1938, and which were then first looted by the Nazis and brought to Berlin, and then looted by the Soviets and brought to Moscow. In a way, these documents are now finally home again. For in fact, the Mises Institute is today the home of Austrian economics, just as the University of Vienna was its home from the 1870s to the 1930s. And so in the coming years, coming months and years, I continue to analyze the Mises files and to write a biography worthy of this great man, whom we all admire and whom we have come to celebrate today. Thank you very much.